Welcome to the deep dive. We're doing something a bit different today. We're really zeroing in on, well, a core piece of the research world. Chapter 2 of a research methods textbook.
Right, foundational stuff.
Exactly. Think of this as your sort of insider's guide to how scientific inquiry, especially in psychology, really gets rolling. Our mission, basically, to unpack those crucial first steps. You know, figuring out what to study.
And finding the topic.
Yeah, and how to ask the right questions. Forming those all-important testable hypotheses.
And this is all based on what this specific chapter lays out for us.
Precisely.
It's actually kind of amazing how much planning, how much thought goes into just these initial stages.
It really is.
This chapter, it really is like the blueprint for, you know, solid empirical research.
Absolutely. And that blueprint, it kind of starts with understanding the different types of knowledge we build on.
Okay.
The chapter introduces us to, well, research papers first, the frontline reports, new discoveries.
Original work, yep.
Then you've got review articles. They're like expert summaries, right? Giving you the current state of play in a field.
Mm-hmm. Synthesizing what's out there.
And theoretical articles. They offer fresh perspectives, maybe new ways of understanding things.
New models, new theories.
And meta-analyses. Those are interesting. They're like the big data of research.
Yeah, statistically combining findings from like loads of studies for a bigger picture.
Exactly.
And the chapter doesn't stop there, does it? It also points to scholarly books, often, you know, much more in-depth.
Right, deeper dives than an article sometimes.
And we shouldn't overlook dissertations and theses. They can be like treasure troves of detail.
Oh, definitely. Sometimes unpublished gems in there.
Plus, case studies, those deep looks at unique situations, right? And even letters to the editor, you know, they can spark debate.
It really is a whole ecosystem of information, isn't it?
It is.
Now, speaking of understanding what's already out there, the chapter really hammers home the crucial role of the literature review.
Oh, absolutely vital.
Why? Well, the big one is you don't want to spend, you know, time and energy answering a question that someone's already answered.
Right. No need to reinvent the wheel, as they say.
Exactly.
And a good literature review, it also helps you figure out if your research question is actually, well, worth pursuing.
Interesting this, right?
Yeah. Is it something that genuinely puzzles the scientific community? Does it, like, fill a real gap in our knowledge?
Or does it have practical implications? Potential real-world impact.
Right. These are the kinds of things a solid review can really help you clarify.
And it's not just about avoiding repetition or checking if it's interesting. The literature review is also a fantastic source of inspiration for how to do your study.
Okay. Yeah. Methods.
What methods have others used? What challenges did they maybe run into?
Learning from their experience.
And crucially, it helps you see where your work fits, you know, into the bigger picture of existing research.
Hmm.
How does it build on what we know or maybe challenge it?
That connection to the existing body of work is just, well, fundamental. Research isn't done in a vacuum.
Never.
The literature review helps you sort of position your study within that ongoing scientific conversation.
Okay, so we know the lit review is key, but where do you even begin? Finding a research topic in the first place.
Good question.
The chapter gives us a few good starting points.
Yeah.
One is simply tuning into your own curiosity.
What makes you tick?
Yeah. What are you genuinely eager to learn more about? What makes you go, I wonder why that is?
That personal interest can be a really powerful driver, you know, for meaningful research.
Definitely.
The chapter also suggests looking at, well, real-world problems. What are the significant issues out there in society, in your field? Where could research actually make a difference?
Practical relevance again.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, diving into the existing literature itself is a prime way to spark new ideas.
Right. Reading what's already been done.
What questions are still unanswered? Are there maybe conflicting findings in different studies?
Yeah. Where are the debates? The inconsistencies?
What new avenues could previous research point towards? The chapter really highlights engaging with what's published.
It's like joining that ongoing discussion we mentioned. You need to know what's been said to contribute something new and valuable.
Makes sense. So once you've got some potential topics brewing, the next step, as the chapter outlines, is crafting a good research question.
Not just any question, a good one.
Exactly. And there's some key ingredients. First off, it absolutely has to be testable.
Testable. Okay. What does that mean exactly?
Well, it means you need to be able to define your concepts, both sort of in a general sense, that's the conceptual definition.
The abstract idea.
Right. And in a way that you can actually measure it, the operational definition. using tools, you know, like surveys, scales, interviews.
Got it. So you need to be able to observe or quantify it somehow.
Precisely.
That ability to move from an abstract idea like happiness to something concrete and measurable is, well, the core of empirical research, isn't it? As the chapter emphasizes.
It really is.
A testable question needs both that clear concept and a practical way to measure it. Like, for happiness, maybe it's a score on a specific happiness scale. That's your operational definition.
Perfect example. Okay, second characteristic the chapter points to. A good research question needs to be specific.
Specific, right. Not too broad.
Yeah, give some helpful examples of things to avoid, like, what are the causes of happiness? Just way too big for one study.
Way too big. Specificity brings focus, makes research actually doable.
Manageable.
Yeah. So instead of that huge happiness question you might ask, is there a relationship between frequency of exercise and self-reported happiness in, say, adults age 30, 45?
Much better. Targeted, testable.
Exactly.
Third thing, a good research question should be interesting.
Interesting. Now that sounds a bit subjective.
Well, the chapter breaks it down. Is the answer currently in doubt, like genuinely unknown or debated?
Okay.
Does it fill a gap in the existing research? Is there something missing that your question addresses?
Right. Adding something new to the conversation.
And does it have potential practical implications? Could the answer actually be useful in the real world?
So it's not just about what you personally find cool, but what the broader scientific community or society might see as valuable.
Exactly. That's a really important distinction the chapter makes. A question might fascinate you, but if the answer is already known, or if it doesn't really add much, it might not be a strong research question.
Yeah, the chapter wisely uses that example. Does it hurt if you punch someone? Not exactly a burning scientific mystery.
No, not really.
Yeah.
Okay, and finally, the chapter emphasizes feasibility.
The practical side.
Yes. You have to be realistic. Do you have the time, the money, the necessary resources, equipment?
The skills needed to actually do the analysis, maybe.
Good point. And can you get access to the participants you need? That can be a huge hurdle.
For sure. There's no point designing this amazing study if you simply can't execute it.
Right.
Feasibility is often, I think, underestimated, especially when you're starting out. It's about being grounded.
Totally grounded.
Yeah.
So you've taken this broad idea, refined it. Specific, testable, interesting, feasible question. Now what?
Well, the chapter then guides us through that shift, doesn't it? From these initial ideas to actual testable empirical questions.
This is where the abstract gets concrete, right? Yeah. The world of scientific investigation.
Exactly. And here the chapter makes a really crucial distinction. Empirical versus non-empirical questions.
Okay.
At its heart, science deals with how the world is. So empirical questions are those you can answer by systematically observing the world.
Like measuring things.
Yeah. A classic example, maybe building on the chapter's discussion, what study habits are linked with higher exam scores in undergrad psych students? We can absorb habits, measure scores.
Makes sense. Empirical, observable.
Right. On the other hand, non-empirical questions, they delve more into values, ethics, how the world ought to be.
Like should questions, moral questions.
Exactly. For instance, should universities require lecture attendance? Important question, sure, but you can't directly answer it just with scientific observation.
Right. Science can investigate, say, the accuracy of a stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
But it can't scientifically determine if holding that stereotype is morally wrong. That's a different kind of question.
And that boundary is just essential for understanding what science can address and what belongs to other important areas, like philosophy or ethics.
Definitely. Building on this idea of testability, the chapter then brings in falsifiability.
Ah, yes. Karl Popper.
Right. Largely credited to him. This is fundamental for scientific claims. It means a claim has to be stated so that it could potentially be shown to be false through observation or experiment.
If there's no possible evidence that could ever contradict it.
Then it's not really a scientific claim, according to this view.
Falsifiability is what separates, you know, genuine scientific theories from things that are basically unfalsifiable, like the chapter's example of ESP.
Extrasensory perception.
Yeah, that supposedly disappears whenever someone tries to observe it directly.
Right. Perfect example of something unfalsifiable.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what the test shows, proponents can always say, oh, it just wasn't working then because you were looking.
Exactly. Compare that to a claim like, people who get more than 8 hours sleep perform better on memory tests.
Okay.
That's falsifiable. We could do a study, collect data, the results might support it or they might contradict it.
Right. The possibility of being proven wrong is there.
And that's crucial for scientific progress, right? It keeps theories accountable to evidence, stops us just clinging to ideas.
Okay, so the chapter then shifts a bit to explore the main goals of science as presented here. It outlines three main objectives. First is description, just providing detailed, accurate accounts of things.
Laying the groundwork.
Yeah. Think about research that meticulously documents, say, the different stages of cognitive development in kids. That's description.
It's the necessary first step. You need a clear picture before you can predict or explain.
Makes sense. Second goal, prediction. Identifying systematic relationships between things. If we consistently see two things tend to happen together,
we can use that to predict future occurrences.
Exactly. The chapter mentions maybe a link between parental involvement in school and student grades. If there's a consistent positive link,
you might predict that more involvement leads to better grades.
Right. Though it's important, as the chapter notes, these predictions in psychology are usually probabilistic, not 100% certainties.
Yeah, tendencies rather than absolutes. Still, prediction is useful. Think about education, mental health, marketing.
Definitely has practical applications. And the third key goal, according to this chapter, explanation.
The why.
Yeah, figuring out the causes of phenomena. This often involves experimental research, right? Where you manipulate one factor to see its effect on another.
Allows you to draw conclusions about cause and effect.
Understanding why something happens.
Yeah.
That's often the ultimate aim.
Explanation goes beyond just seeing patterns. It's about the underlying mechanisms driving them. Answering those why questions.
Okay. Following these goals, the chapter then draws a really helpful distinction between basic and applied research.
Ah, that's an important one.
Basic research is mainly driven by wanting to expand our fundamental knowledge. Just understanding something better, whether or not it has immediate practical use.
Knowledge for knowledge's sake, essentially.
Kind of, yeah. Applied research, on the other hand, is directly focused on tackling specific practical problems in the real world.
Solving issues, finding solutions.
Right.
It's more of a spectrum, obviously.
Right.
But understanding the main motivation is useful. Basic research often lays that groundwork.
That applied research then builds on to solve those real-world problems.
Yeah.
The chapter encourages us to think of examples, which is great. Like basic research on memory processes.
Compared to applied research on, say, the best ways to teach students with learning disabilities.
Exactly. One builds fundamental understanding, the other applies it directly.
Got it. And to maintain the rigor and trustworthiness of all this, the chapter really underscores adopting an attitude of skepticism.
Skepticism, not cynicism, though.
Right. Important difference. It's not about just doubting everything automatically. It's approaching claims with a critical eye, considering alternatives.
Seeking empirical evidence before you just accept conclusions. Demanding proof.
Yeah. It's a vital safeguard against biases, against jumping to conclusions too quickly.
Being open to the possibility that maybe your initial assumptions are wrong. The chapter's example about weekly allowance and financial responsibility.
Right. You need to pause and evaluate the evidence, not just accept a common belief.
Critical evaluation.
Okay. Now, the chapter dives into two main ways or pathways for generating and testing these research ideas.
Okay.
The first is the hypothetico-deductive method, often called theory testing.
Top down.
Exactly. You start with a broad theory that tries to explain something. From that theory, you deduce a specific, testable prediction that's your hypothesis.
Then you test it.
Right. You conduct an empirical study.
Yeah.
And the results help you either support the theory, maybe refine it, or even reject it.
So, moving from general theory to specific prediction and test, the chapter's example about social learning theory leading to a hypothesis about imitation fits this well.
It does. The second approach is the inductive method, often called data-driven.
Bottom up.
Right. Here, you might start by collecting data, maybe without a super specific hypothesis yet.
More exploratory.
Yeah. You analyze the data, look for patterns, and from those patterns, you develop new ideas or theories. The hypothesis might emerge from the data.
So observations and data lead to theory, like the chapter's example of observing unexpected online behaviors and then building a theory to explain them. That's inductive.
Perfect. But whether you're using deduction or induction, the chapter stresses that developing a clear hypothesis is critical.
Absolutely.
Hypothesis, as the chapter defines it, is that specific, testable prediction about a new phenomena, often derived from theory. It's your educated guess.
Your prediction of what you expect to find. It gives your research direction.
Exactly. Guides your methods, lets you evaluate your ideas empirically. And when you're crafting that hypothesis, the chapter points out, you need to consider if it should be directional or non-directional.
One-tailed versus two-tailed?
Right. A directional or one-tail hypothesis makes a specific prediction about the direction of the relationship or difference.
Like X will be higher than Y.
Exactly. For instance, if prior research strongly suggests, say, more stress leads to worse cognitive performance, your directional hypothesis might be high-stress individuals will score lower on a cognitive task than low-stress individuals.
So you use that when you have a solid basis prior research, strong theory, to predict the direction.
Right. A non-directional or two-tailed hypothesis just predicts a relationship or a difference, but doesn't specify the direction.
Just that X will be different from Y.
Yeah. Like, there will be a significant difference in job satisfaction between remote and office workers.
Yeah.
You're not saying who will be more satisfied, just that they'll differ.
So that's more cautious. You use that if the research is maybe inconclusive or could go either way.
Makes sense. The chapter emphasizes, though, that a directional hypothesis is stronger if you have good justification for it.
Right. If you can back up that specific prediction.
Okay. The chapter then loops back to the research literature itself. Its role in these early stages.
Can't escape the lit review.
No. It reiterates that scholarly journals, especially peer-reviewed ones, are essential.
The gold standard, really.
And it goes into detail about that double-blind peer review process. How work gets submitted, sent to experts.
Who critique it constructively.
And the editor makes a decision. Accept, revise, reject. It's crucial for maintaining quality and integrity.
That double-blind part reviewers don't know authors, authors don't know reviewers is key. Helps guard against bias, judging the work on its merit.
Exactly. Beyond journals, the chapter reminds us about scholarly books, dissertations, theses, also valuable resources.
Yeah, dissertations often have way more detail than a published article. Worth checking out.
Definitely. So what specifically should you be looking for in that literature review, according to the chapter?
Good question. What are the goals?
Several key things. Refining your initial research question based on what others found.
Okay, sharpening your focus.
Identifying appropriate research methods others have used successfully.
Learning how they did it.
Placing your own research in that broader context. How does it fit in?
Connecting it to the field.
And understanding how others presented their findings. That can be invaluable when you write your own report later.
Yeah, learning from the collective knowledge to strengthen your own work.
Finally, the chapter circles back to evaluating your research questions.
Yeah.
Reinforcing interestingness.
Is the answer in doubt? Fills a gap. Practical implications.
And feasibility.
Time, money, equipment, skills, access. The practical stuff again.
Right. The chapter's examples, like the punch causing pain being uninteresting, really helps clarify what makes a question worthwhile investigating.
Yeah, concrete examples help. And as the chapter emphasizes, this whole process, it's rarely just a straight line.
Oh, definitely not.
It's often iterative. You start with an idea, make it a question, do a lit review.
And realize you need to go back and tweak the question based on what you learned.
Exactly. It's a continuous cycle of refinement. Thinking, reading, refining.
Absolutely. It's quite dynamic, quite creative, actually, even though it follows this structured framework.
It really is. Requires both critical thinking and that willingness to adapt as you learn more.
Okay, let's try and sort of recap here. We've taken a really good dive into Chapter 2 of this research methods text. Covered a lot of ground.
A foundational ground.
Yeah. We looked at the different types of sources researchers use, papers, reviews, books.
Meta-analyses, dissertations.
Right. Explored why that literature review is just so essential.
Can't skip it.
Discussed how to actually find research topics.
Yeah.
Curiosity, real-world problems, the literature itself.
Mm-hmm.
And broke down what makes a good research question. Testable, specific, interesting, and feasible.
Those four pillars.
We also looked at moving from broad ideas to empirical questions. The difference between empirical and non-empirical.
And that key concept of falsifiability, Popper.
Exactly. Touched on the goals of science. Description, prediction, explanation.
And basic versus applied research.
And
we explored the importance of skepticism, critical thinking, not cynicism. The hypothetico-deductive top-down approach.
Versus the inductive bottom-up approach.
Right. Developing hypotheses, directional or non-directional. The significance of the research literature, again, peer review.
What to look for in that review. Evaluating questions again based on interestingness and feasibility.
And wrapping up with that idea that it's an iterative, ongoing process.
Phew. Okay. So what does all this mean for you, our listener?
Yeah, the takeaway.
Well, whether you're a student just starting out or maybe just someone curious about how psychological knowledge gets built. Understanding these basics is key.
Absolutely. These first steps, finding focus, asking good questions, grounding it in what's known, they're just crucial.
They really set the stage for any meaningful scientific exploration.
And despite sounding systematic, these early stages really are dynamic. They need creativity, critical thought.
Definitely. So here's a final thought for you to mull over. Think about some everyday observation, maybe a piece of common wisdom you hear all the time.
Okay.
How could you take that and actually turn it into a testable research question? What kind of prior research might be relevant?
And importantly, what makes that question genuinely interesting and worth pursuing scientifically?
That's your food for thought. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.